You're listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research conference podcast. I'm the center's director, Ann Stevens. In October 2015, the center hosted the conference Employment, Earnings, and Inequality: Realities and Opportunities in Low-Wage Labor Markets. The conference featured experts on labor markets who presented both quantitative and qualitative research on a wide variety of topics, including wages, shifts in occupations, immigration, and the lives of low-skilled workers. In this presentation, Paul Osterman discusses the low-wage labor market and policies that affect low-wage workers. Osterman is the Nanyang Technological University Professor of Human Resources and Management at the MIT Sloan School of Management, as well as a member of the Department of Urban Planning at MIT.
I'm actually not going to give a real talk. You've had a series of quite real, I've listened to it all, as of you all. You've had a series of really quite interesting, serious papers that people have presented. And I'm going to do something different. I'm going to bloviate. Do people know what the term bloviate means? I think Frank Rich invented it, but who? What? You want me to bloviate louder? No. I mean, it could be a quiet bloviate, too. So I'm going to bloviate. That is to say, I'm going to kind of free associate a little bit about these issues. But what I hope to do is to kind of give you kind of a way of thinking about what you've heard and expose you to kind of a little bit to kind of how I think about what's going on in low-wage labor markets. And I'm going to talk about fundamentally about policy, right? So my assumption is that, that at the end of the day, what we're all interested in, all the folks in this room, is helping people in bad jobs have better lives, right? Which means either improving their mobility prospects or improving the quality of jobs that they have. And at the end of the day, that's what all this research is about. And so if that's the ultimate goal, if that's kind of the policy objective that we're all interested in, there was water down here somewhere? Yep. If that's the kind of policy objective we're all interested in, then how do we think about it? And when you put it in that way, I think it opens up a kind of a slightly different way of thinking about it. So, for example, and I'm going to come to this, it may well be the case that over the long term, polarization, I'm going to talk about this in more detail, polarization, skill bias, technological change is going to shape the distribution of jobs that are available for people. But what about the next 5 years? What about the next 8 years? That is to say, what about the situation of people who are entering the labor market now? What about the situation of middle-aged people who are trying to do better in low-wage jobs? It's not clear that the long-run trends that we study in our academic literature are relevant to that question. Something else is relevant to that question. So that's the kind of frame that I'm going to kind of bring to this discussion. It's going to be kind of a very grounded, kind of policy-oriented frame. So what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to begin, for anybody who knows me well, the way you'd expect me to begin, by being very cranky. And I'm going to complain about some of the ways people are thinking and talking about what's going on in the labor market. And then after I've gotten that out of my system, I'm going to offer a framework, what I think is a framework, for thinking about policy, in part building on what Ken just said. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the supply side, the skill issues. And you've already heard a couple of very interesting discussions of skills from Jacqueline and from David Green. I'm going to add to the discussion of skills a little bit. And then my fundamental point, and what my real contribution, if there is one, to this conference, is to try and force you all, or force us, to think about firms and industries in much more detail, in a much more kind of analytical way than we have. And if you think about all the talks you've heard today, and I'm not being mean when I say this, it's just a descriptive fact, any detail about employers has been almost non-existent, right? Any detail about industry structure has been almost non-existent, right? The conversation has either been about the characteristics of workers or about the characteristics of kind of aggregate numbers, right? Average wages, average employment levels, employment to population ratios. We haven't really drilled down to talk about why is the restaurant industry different than the hotel industry, different than the hospital industry. But the case I'm going to try and make to you after I kind of get cranky for a while, the case I'm going to try and make to you is that to really make, at least one way of making progress to improve people's jobs, you've got to understand these industries in more detail than is characteristic of any of the discussions, not just today, but any of the discussions that, that takes place around this stuff. Okay, so my first crank one. Two presenters showed slides drawing from NELP. I love NELP. NELP's a great organization. Saying that there's a trajectory towards bad jobs in the economy. That, you know, more bad jobs are being created than good jobs. Coming out of the Great Recession, all the jobs have been created. I think this is wrong. Now, what I'm saying is not obiter dicta. I'm not God. NELP would tell you that I'm wrong. Right? So, I mean, this is open to discussion. But I think the weakness in the kind of charts and so forth that get produced on this is that if you put on your real economist hat, you want to say, what's the trajectory of job quality over time? You'd want to control for the business cycle. You want to look at peak to peak or trough to trough. But NELP is looking, and the other folks who do this, they're tending to look at trough to peak. Right? So if you look at peak to peak, and this is, I did this last year, but 2001 was a peak, 2007 was a peak, 2013 was as close to a peak as I could get in 2013. And you look at either two ways of thinking about this. Just ask about the percentage of people who are of work, adults, not kids, adults who are holding jobs that are 150% of the poverty line or below. Or you do this kind of thing of assigning a wage level to a job at the beginning of the period, 2001, and then looking at the distribution over time. Either way, there's not a trend towards more bad jobs in the economy. Now, the fact that 30% of American adults hold poverty-level jobs is a shocking number. I'm not telling you that there's not a serious problem out there. But I do think we're not doing ourselves a service by saying, oh my God, it's getting worse, oh my God, it's getting worse, oh my God, it's getting worse. And we can talk about this, but I think you want to be more careful about that kind of claim. More cranks. The labor market, in my view, in the medium run, is not rapidly becoming more polarized. I'm going to give you some data on this. But this is a really important point, because if we're becoming a barbell economy, or whatever metaphor you want to use, either really great jobs, right, brain surgery or a professor of economics, or maybe that should be in the lousy jobs, or really lousy jobs, then people who are in the lousy jobs don't really have anywhere to go, right? Because people aren't going to go from working as a barista or cleaning rooms in the hotel to, you know, professional jobs. That's just not going to happen, realistically. But in fact, as I'll show you, that's not the world we live in. And so all this discussion about polarization and barbell economy, I think I think it's empirically wrong, but it's also doing a disservice. All this high road and low road discussion, Ken mentioned Zeynep Tom, a wonderful person, is a colleague of mine, but you know, she does what a lot of people do. You should look at Costco, oh, you should look at SAS, oh, you should look at the five good firms that I can think of that are really in some industry and are high road firms. I would claim to you that if you do that, all these firms are idiosyncratic in some way. They've got a founder who's got a vision. They're not publicly traded. There's something about those firms that make them not generalizable. I find the high road, low road, let me show you this bakery that really treats its workers well, Zingerman's or whatever. I find that a misleading discussion because I don't think it characterizes the economy. And then finally, and this is not relevant to my talk at all, we are not becoming a gig economy. And I think what Ken said about Uber and taxi drivers is exactly right. It's taxi drivers who we're feeling sorry for also independent contractors, and they make lousy wages. So why are we picking on Uber? I don't mean to defend Uber, but you know. But if you look at the data on multiple job holdings, if you look at the data on independent contracting, they simply don't show the trends that people talk about. Okay, those are the cranks. Now, on to the real stuff, what I want to talk about. If you think about how to improve jobs, how to improve the circumstances of people in low-wage jobs, this is kind of a framework for thinking about strategy. One is mobility. And that involves skills. So there's you work with the schools, you work with the community colleges, and you work with second chance systems. And in another conversation, I'd have a ton to say about this, particularly about actually about community college systems and second chance systems. But it's a skill-focused strategy. The other strategy is improving job quality. And there's two sub-pieces to that. One is power. Power through government power, through regulation, or organized power through unions, through worker centers, through living wage campaigns, and the like. And the other way of improving job quality is by thinking deeply about how to change how jobs are organized and structured, make them into better jobs. And I'm really going to focus mostly on that last thing. Ken did a very good job of focusing on the power piece. I'm going to come back at the very end and talk about how the two integrate, how the two fit together. But a few quick words on skill. There's a lot of literature on skill. You've heard a couple of good talks about skill. Traditionally, we measure skill by education. In fact, Jacqueline, the field is, even economists have become more subtle, right? So you heard David talk about this routine, non-routine discussion. The O-Net is out there with a lot of different ways of measuring skill. And there are some surveys out there, and I'm going to present briefly one of them, that directly ask employers about what skills they're looking for. But the question is, in the context of low-wage work, how important is lack of skill in explaining why some people are poor? So there's clearly a strong relationship between education and hourly earnings. That's clear. Everyone knows that. There's also, though, even holding our education constant, this is among young people between the ages of 31 and 39, there's quite a distribution. So these are people who have only a high school degree and who are between 31 and 39, and you can see that there's a substantial earnings distribution among these people. This is just saying that the R square is not that great, right? There's a lot going on beyond education levels and driving earnings outcomes. If we ask about the nature of job openings, are jobs becoming polarized? Are we moving towards this barbell economy driven by technology or whatever else you care about? A really important distinction to make, and one that I think is often lost in the discussion, is the distinction between net jobs and gross jobs. So the discussion is often about two endpoints. What percentage of jobs today are brain surgeons, and what percentage of jobs in 10 years are going to be brain surgeons? That's net, right? What percentage of jobs today are going to be production line workers, and what percentage of jobs are going to be production line workers? And that shows somewhat of a dramatic change. But guess what? Everybody my age except me is going to retire, okay? And get older. I'm just going to lose more hair. And so there's going to be a lot of gross job openings that people can move into. So here's just an illustration of that point. Net, this is BLS numbers, net employment change for production workers to the year 2022, plus 75,000. No growth in production line workers, no surprise. Replacement openings, because people are going to retire, 1.8 million. Lots of opportunities for people to move into jobs. Now, remember what I said. I'm interested in the 5-year horizon, the 8-year horizon, getting people who are in crappy jobs into good jobs. And for those people, that 1.8 million figure is a more important number than the 75,000 figure. So if you think about polarization that way, I would want to argue to you that it's been substantially exaggerated in the public debate with respect to skill. Okay. Are the skills that are being demanded within the reach of most people? I did a survey what's called advanced manufacturing firms, random national survey of about 1,000 advanced manufacturing firms, asked them very, very concrete questions about skills. Do you need someone to read a manual of 1 page, 2 pages, 3 pages? Do they have to do algebra, trigonometry? Do they have to be able to do CAD/CAM, blah, blah, all very concrete skills about production workers. The skill demands were basically community college, advanced high school, community college level skills. They were not brain surgery skills. They're not skills from most jobs are in the reach of most people. That's the only point I'm trying to pound down here, because it's really important. Okay. Okay, moving on to what I really wanted to talk about, which is this point about industries. So this is a chart for some industries. It tells you two things. The first column is, among those industries, what percentage of low-wage work, total low-wage work in the economy? I define low-wage work as 150% of the poverty line for the hourly wage. What percentage of low-wage work do these industries account for? So you can see, for example, that retail jobs account for almost 18% of all low-wage jobs in the economy. You can see that education is 7%, healthcare 12%, and so on. The second column is, among the jobs in those industries, what percentage are low-wage? And you can see that some industries are very heavily low-wage industries, right? So retail is almost half are low-wage jobs. Food services and drinking establishments, almost three-quarters are low-wage jobs. So what this suggests is that if you want to think about a strategy that's kind of a strategy that's strategic about where you're going to go after, what industries you're going to think about, you want to understand how industries vary along these dimensions. There's also economics literature that tells you that firms and industries are important. So there's always, when there's anytime there's a worker, an employee-employee survey out there, there's always a very substantial residual for the firm. There are examples of firms in the same industries that organize work in different ways. Human resource practices cluster together. There's a lot of literature, academic literature, suggesting that it makes sense to focus on firms and industries as kind of an analytical category. So I'm going to kind of illustrate this point briefly with two industries. And what I want to hope to do is to show you, and this can be very quick. I'm going to be done in a few minutes. You're going to have your beer really soon. I'm going to show you very quickly that these are two industries with a lot of low-wage workers, that they're structured very differently, and that points to a different way of thinking about how to improve the jobs in those industries, hotels and home health. So what can you say about hotels? Hotels are organized by quality segments. There's very different quality segments in the hotel industry. The hotel industry, there's a substantial separation between ownership and management. And a lot of the ownership is very distant, sometimes it's private equity. Okay? And management's very different. So owners hire managers to run them. There's a lot of outsourcing of low-wage jobs in the hotel industry. There's national chains and brands are important. And the internal labor markets, the job letters in hotels, are fairly flat. There's not a lot of places for someone who cleans a hotel room to go. Okay? Unlike, say, hospitals, which I'll talk about in another context in a few minutes, in which there are very substantially longer potential job ladders. So what are the implications of that, that very quick and dirty analysis of the hotel industry? Particularly in the upper segment, there's margins for improvement. There's money out there. You can pressure the brand image. The internal labor markets are flat, so developing, trying to create career ladders may be a relatively problematic strategy in the hotel industry. National campaigns are feasible, so you can go after Hyatt. You can go after Hyatt in Chicago and change your practices in Boston, actually, is what recently happened in a particular case. And it's important in the hotel industry to think about the owners as well as the managers in terms of where you're going after and who you're talking to and who you're putting pressure on. So that's, if there's anyone in the room who really knows the hotel industry, you're embarrassed for me. But that's a quick and dirty analysis of the hotel industry and kind of what it suggests and why you want to have an industry analysis. Now, the home health aid industry is one that I'm obsessed about. This is a longer slide. I'm writing a book about it. I spent the last year studying it. I'm now deep in writing a book about how to improve these jobs. There's about 3 million of them in America today. There's going to be about 6 million of them in America in 10 years. And they pay on average about $9 an hour. They're about 85% women, maybe 90%. It's an extraordinarily complex industry. So the demand, there's two sources of demand, old folks and disabled folks. And that's very different kinds of demand from those two categories. If you're a home health aide, you may be working for elderly, or you may be working for disabled, younger disabled, or you may be working for both. And both the skills that are needed, but also the trajectory of demand is quite different. The industry structure is incredibly complicated. So when I say two worlds, California is a world. California has California, Washington, and Oregon, and then a few smattering of places around the country have what's called consumer-directed systems, in which the home health, in which the client hires the aide, pays the aide, supervises the aide, and can fire the aide. Pays the aide is complicated, but hires and can fire the aide. Most of the rest of the country have agencies. You call up the agency and say, my mother needs an aide, and the agency sends an aide. Very, very different, because in a consumer-directed world, about 75% of these aides are relatives of the client, which has tremendous implications for regulation and for job quality and all kinds of things. In the agency world, that's just not the case. Most agencies are nonprofits. There are some for-profit chains, and since this is Silicon Valley, there's now a few online for-profit chains that are moving towards IPOs. What all would you expect? But most of the world is nonprofit agencies. There's a large subterranean market out there. No one knows how big it is. Unregulated and unknown in terms of its size. The nonprofit agencies and much of the consumer-directed world are paid out of Medicaid. And as Ken pointed out, if there's no money, there's no money. So if you, for example, raise the minimum wage, and this is, or as has happened, just happened last 2 months ago, put home health aides under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and there's no adjustment on state appropriations, and guess what? Most states, not going to be an adjustment. What happens? Either hours get cut for the aides, or the state becomes much tougher on eligibility standards for the clients. So that's a huge constraint on this industry. Failure to internalize. For the old folks, Medicaid, most of them are what's called duals. They're both on Medicaid and Medicare. But guess what? Medicaid doesn't care about Medicare, and vice versa. So Medicaid is willing, if Medicaid pays an aide who does something and sends a person, has to call 911 and send them to the emergency room, that's paid for by Medicare. So Medicaid, for example, doesn't face a positive incentive to provide better care that reduces health care costs, because that's somebody else's problem, their friends over at Medicare. So the system is extremely bizarre in terms of its structure, of its incentive structure. There's a movement to manage care, which may internalize those incentives. We'll see if that happens. The politics are very complicated. In about six states, there's unions. The unions are quite different. So in New York, the home health aid union is part of the hospital workers union and the nursing home union. And guess who's on the bottom? And this is me speaking, my view. I just spent a year talking. Who's on the bottom of that totem pole in terms of the union politics? It's the home health aides. California and Washington have strong unions. It's a different circumstance. But the unions are back on their heels because of a recent Supreme Court decision, which has cut their legs out in terms of their ability to get agency fees, to collect dues. And finally, medicine is dominated by a medical culture in which it's totally credentialized, as we all know, and aides are totally at the bottom of the totem pole. And they have an enemy. Who do you think the enemy of aides are? Guess. Nurses. So there's tremendous war over the scope of practice and what aides can and cannot do, and pushing back against aides are nurses. So I love this industry. Buy my book if I ever write this book. But It's incredibly complicated. And then, therefore, that then has a whole set of issues about how you make these jobs better. And you can imagine what they are. And so this is just a couple of them, right? I've already told you about the Medicaid incentive problem. The consumer-directed world, when the Fair Labor Standards Act kicked in, all hell broke loose because it doesn't fit the consumer-directed world. Because in the consumer-directed world, you've hired your cousin to take care of you, and you're connected to that person, and if your cousin is working 12 hours a day, you're going to pay her overtime, or the state's going to force you actually to only let her work 8 and have a stranger come in for those other 4 to avoid the overtime. It doesn't work. Whereas in the agency world, it does work. So it's just, okay, so what I've done is to kind of make the case that if you really want to go after this low-wage problem, beyond kind of a regulatory broad brush, you really need to understand your industry, understand what's going on. So the two strategies that I would talk about are standards and intermediaries and sectoral programs. Ken just did an excellent job of talking about standards, so I'm not going to talk about standards. Intermediaries and sectoral programs are essentially programs around the country that have what's called a dual client perspective. Their clients are both the firms or the industry and the workers. They do training, but they also work with firms to kind of improve their human resource practices. They develop industry expertise. They act as a surrogate HR department. They provide support to the trainees. They do long-term training, blah, blah, blah. There's best practices out there. There's a lot of this out there. So some are done by business associations, unions, community organizations, other nonprofits are engaged in these sectoral programs, these partnerships to kind of upgrade low-wage jobs. Funding comes from foundations, from federal monies, from state training funds, and then in some cases from private sources. Here's just some examples. There's a lot of, in the hospital industry where job ladders are long, there's a lot of efforts to build these career ladders, take you out, you know, you no longer move you from the laundry to being some kind of patient care technician, which is a form of a CNA, to maybe a phlebotomist. I'm obsessed about home health aides. Internal training, there's efforts to upgrade training in manufacturing firms, changing firms' recruitment patterns, getting firms to recruit from neighborhoods, which historically they've ignored. There's a lot of different kind of tactics and strategies for these intermediaries. It's very tough. These are small, 100, 200 clients, very hard to work with firms. Getting firms to play ball is difficult. In this current environment, it's difficult. But these are models that are out there. They're models throughout the country, and in some respects are quite promising on the kind of work with firms and hold their hands to make their jobs better. So what's the sweet spot? This is my last slide. What's the sweet spot in terms of this? The sweet spot is using power, in my view, using power and pressure, namely organizing, plus these intermediary sectoral programs. The power and the pressure brings employers to the table. And these intermediary sectoral programs then makes it worthwhile for them to be at the table and does something for them. And so you see that. I mean, there's a community organizing network around the country that I've done a lot of work with, the Industrial Areas Foundation and Alinsky Network, which has a lot of these things in the Southwest and basically uses its organizing power to bring employers to the table and then runs these kind of sectoral programs. They're not unique. Other places do that too in different parts of the country. And that, in my view, from the point of view of kind of industry analysis, the kind of policy perspective I'm trying to give you, I think is the sweet spot. I'm not claiming to you that this is the only thing out there or the only important thing out there. I think increasing the minimum wage is fundamentally important. Thinking about paid sick leave, the kinds of things that Ken was talking about are fundamentally important. But I'm trying to make the case that it's important to think about other dimensions and other ways of thinking about improving job quality. Thank you. I'm done. I know you want your beer, but you got to ask me at least one question.
I get like death stares when I have a question. Everyone's so you mentioned in terms of the home health aid industry, the point of intervention is to change the industry structure. That seems kind of broad. So
I mean, what am I thinking about?
Yeah.
I think it all comes down, in my view, to changing. Well, so there's these two worlds. There's this consumer-directed world, and there's this agency world. And what you have to do is different in each of these. In the agency world, which is consumer-directed world, there's about nationally maybe 600,000 aides working in that, and there's about 2.4 million working in the agency world. Above the table, I don't know how many are below the table, though I actually have a clever way of trying to figure that out. If it works, I'll have an answer to you. In the agency world, I think what you have to do is to change the incentive structure of payers so that you internalize these costs, what I described, and give them an incentive to save money by giving these aides more skill. So right now, they have no incentive for these aides to do more because there's no payoff to them for it. But if we move to managed care, for example, and we internalize it, then there could be a payoff. Then the next question is, how do you make that happen? Because maybe they'll change the nature of the jobs of the aides and not pay them anymore. So then you have to think about, you know, how you deal with that problem. And you have to deal with the nurses who will oppose this. My daughter is in nursing school. I haven't yet discussed this with her, really. So, you know, there is a strategy, but... Yeah?
So the first thing is... And I actually like this a lot. The first point about that we don't pay enough attention to firms, I think, yeah, is really true. It's sort of interesting if you look at labor economics over time. You know, we used to actually have demand. It's like, still, if you teach demand, you've got to be teaching things that are old. And that's not even at the level what you're talking about. It's just... Basically, along came these individual level data sets, and that was the easy thing to study, and we spent a long time on that. And then your whole point that it's even more, you know, drilling down, I think it's really true. But, and it's even, if you look at that skill bias technical change literature, a lot of that, they, you know, those production functions are written down with capital separate, so you get rid of capital. Right? Even at the high level, we don't.
Yeah.
But, I had sort of two questions. One is just, I fully understand your first cranky point. And then the second question is the policy business.
My wife says that to me constantly when I'm... She doesn't understand my cranky...
I didn't care more. That's
good. So what was the first cranky point?
The first one is this thing about, oh, the high road, low road thing. You think it's just like a sideshow, and that, you know, Zane of Ton Singh is like, it's all very well and good, but it really... But then you go on to say, oh, we need to change organization. That affirmative X exists. I mean, you know, it's true, you can take any case and say, oh, here's five examples. But I mean, as you said later in your talk, it's like firm effects in wage equations exist, and they suggest that therefore it's not just five.
I think that is a contradiction, what I said. But here's my problem with the kind of... Actually, I shouldn't pick on Zena. Jeff Pfeffer, if anyone knows who Jeff Pfeffer, he's written all these books about great firms. There's very little in that literature about the content. Those firms are in a particularly distinctive context. Either they are owner, either they have these visionary founders, or they're not publicly traded. Costco has a visionary founder. These bakeries, yeah. And so you can't generalize from those firms. So holding the typical context within that context, yeah, there's some distribution of firm behavior. I guess what I'm reacting to is the kind of examples that get given, as opposed to, you referred to the Acemoglu. Acemoglu and somebody thing, the high road, low road. But that's saying that the average firm can make different decisions within the same labor market, financial structure, capital market structure context. Whereas all this kind of loose examples just don't embed their example in any. That's what.
But But isn't there a sense in which, like, what you're calling for is some way? I mean, one way you can say is, okay, there are examples of firms where we can see how we can organize things better, however they can be better. And then what we're trying to do with policy is try to figure out how to
force the firm. That's right. But I want to change the context. So, you know, I can't make everybody privately held. Yeah, okay, but I accept your point.
Okay, and then the other was a policy question, which is, some background, there's a paper that I saw not very long ago, this is Canadian stuff again, where what they did was they sort of estimated the impact of all the various union rules across provinces, it's at the provincial level in Canada, on impacts on unionization rates. So these are, you know, this is like, you know, is it secret ballot, is it the various things that can control the union. They sort of figured out, you know, who would be impacted by that. They then took that and they went back and they said, suppose every province had the most generous rules that we've seen in the last 20 years. And now what would that do to wage inequality? And the answer was not much, partly because of, you know, where in the structure it affected them. So it's sort of like playing with union rules, playing with unionization within, and this is within, this is like making every province union. We don't know, but again, Alberta is very anti-union, Quebec is very pro-union. This is like taking, this is like really big
stuff. Sure.
And it does very little. So then when you talk about this sort of sectoral pressure, are you calling for like a complete reorganization of the notion of unions in the U.S.? Are you talking about going to a model more like a German model? Or
no, no, I wasn't clear. When I talk about the sectoral, you mean my last slide putting, first off, I think it's important to distinguish between inequality and good jobs. So I'm not necessarily talking about changing the Gini coefficient or changing the 90-10, you know. I'm talking about making sure that there are no jobs that fall below some threshold of decency. You could still have a lot of inequality because you could have a lot of people making a lot more money. But I'm interested in making sure that no one's making $9 an hour. Or, you know, that's a different goal than talking about inequality. Okay, so that helps answer that question, because if you could snap your fingers and unionize all these jobs, you might not have a big effect on the Gini coefficient or whatever measure you want to use, but you certainly would raise many of these jobs above some level, some threshold. That said, I'm not arguing that the answer to all this is unionization, because I'm not optimistic about the prospects of private sector unions over any time horizon.
So then where does the pressure come from?
So the pressure could come politically. It could come through, you've seen these corporate campaigns. You've seen community organizing and communities around living wage campaigns. You've seen worker centers. You've seen a variety of, I mean, that's one of the most interesting things about the last 15 years in this country. Canadians are much better behaved, so they don't do this. But, you know, you've proven something that's not true. I always thought Canadians had no sense of humor, but...
Do you know how many of your comedians are Canadian? All the funny ones moved down here and make a lot of money.
That's because no one laughed up there. Anyway, there's been a tremendous amount of kind of energy, local energy, putting pressure on firms.
But just to follow up on that, though, the impact of unions goes well beyond the in-firm impact. And we look at all of this stuff that's happening that, you know, I presented. The Fight for 15 is a campaign of the Service Employees
Association. Yeah, sure.
And to me, this big irony of what's happening right now, or if irony is the right word here, is we're seeing, on some level, unprecedented success on the part of labor on raising wages for low-wage workers.
No, you're making a very good point.
And at the same time,
Without increasing membership.
Increasing their own membership, and then with the Friedrichs decision coming down in the summer in terms of public sector workers, we could see a significant decrease in union density among public sector workers, which has been the real basis behind the support for all of this. And so when I think about the difference the part of that is those individuals will make more money from the union, but the bigger issue is what's the role the unions play overall in terms of the power around broader sets of economic changes and policy changes that also affect larger numbers of people. And I think all of these worker center models are interesting. None of them have figured out how to be self-sustaining financially. And I think
that's right.
Big question out there is that.
And the other thing that you didn't mention is government purchasing. You talked about government employment. Obama's issued a number of executive orders regarding government purchasing, which is another source of pressure. Yeah, but I think these are hard questions. I agree with you.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.